family. This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The people of Afghanistan took a huge step this weekend toward a more stable, democratic future, voting in a relatively calm national election with an estimated 58% of those eligible casting ballots. But it'll take many weeks to figure out which of the 8 presidential candidates won, with tough terrain and the remoteness of many villages. Also, there were few international elections monitors present. Many fled the country after deadly attacks earlier this year on hotels and restaurants frequented by foreigners. Still, many Afghans who cast ballots said they were pleased to do so, hoping it sets their nation on a new, better course after years of conflict and government corruption. Today in The Exchange, sifting through the Afghanistan elections. Let's hear from you. Were you watching these elections? What were your hopes and concerns? And as the U.S. prepares to pull forces out of Afghanistan by the end of this year, what do you think will happen? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have 3 guests for the hour. With me in studio, Sarwar Kashmiri, adjunct professor of international relations at Norwich University, fellow at the Foreign Policy Association. Sarwar is the author of NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete. Sarwar, always nice to see you. Thank you for coming in.
And always nice to see you, Laura.
Joining us from Dartmouth is Professor John Kerry. He's chair of the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, a political scientist there. And he traveled to Afghanistan in 2012 to consult on electoral reform. And Professor Kerry, good to have you, too. Thanks for taking time out for us.
Thanks, Laura. Good morning.
And joining us from Rhode Island is Colonel Bob Cassidy. He's an Army colonel, professor at the Naval War College in Newport. He recently served in Afghanistan as a special assistant to the operational commander. He just came back from Afghanistan this past February. And Colonel Cassidy, good to have you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Laura. I'm happy to be here.
Well, and Colonel Cassidy, I'll turn to you first, since you were just so recently in Afghanistan. What's your reaction to the voting this weekend, Colonel Cassidy? A violent buildup to the elections, but then it seemed like the actual voting day went relatively well.
Oh, I'm very happy about the outcome of this first part of the election. The turnout was good. The performance of the Afghan security forces was especially good in terms of circumscribing the violence. And then the turnout of the people, 7 million Afghans, showed their resilience and their faith in a better future with a new head of state. I would probably just like to point out that what happens with the outcome of the election, this is only the first part of a multiple month-long process, is that it could very well determine the outcome for security and stability in Afghanistan for the next 10 years or more, because the election is tied to the bilateral security agreement, and the bilateral security agreement is tied to continued international commitment in terms of funding and advisors.
Yeah, and I know that is a big, big question at stake, the future of the relationship with the U.S. and what it's going to look like. But just getting to the elections for just a moment again, Colonel Cassidy, what were your fears going into it? Again, you were there during the buildup to the whole election day.
Yes. Preceding the election, I was really more concerned about the conduct of the election by the Afghans. My fear was that the Afghans themselves could delegitimize the election, more so than I was concerned about the Taliban disrupting the elections with violence. They can attack weaknesses and they can attack cities because it's impossible to prevent isolated attacks. But what I saw of the Afghan security forces last summer and fall during the first fighting season when they were in the full lead, so when the Taliban do attack, the Afghan security forces have demonstrated relative alacrity and capability in responding to attacks and either destroying, killing the Taliban or returning the situation to normalcy.
So improvements on the security side. And Professor Kerry, on the electoral side, again, you went to Afghanistan in 2012 to consult on elections there. What were your concerns going into this vote over the weekend?
Well, one big concern had to be turnout, that response has been really reassuring. If we think back, the first presidential election was in 2004 in Afghanistan, and the turnout was pretty high. And the second election in 2009, turnout declined quite a bit, partly, I think, because of the security situation, partly also because of disillusionment with the electoral process at the time. And so, you know, one of the big questions yesterday, or I guess over the weekend, was, you know, what was the response going to be on the third try? And it seems to have rebounded. So that is a pretty important, encouraging sign.
Yeah, so worried about violence, as Colonel Cassidy said, and also worried about the purity of the vote itself, given that elections monitors weren't really there, were they, Professor Carey?
Not in the numbers that they have been in the past, you know, largely because of the violence, as you mentioned, in the couple of months preceding the election. So, yeah, I think there was good reason for concern, and at least the first, you know, our first response in the immediate aftermath has to be you know, surpassing expectations, I guess.
Remind us.
There's a long way to go, though.
Yeah.
Because the sort of post-electoral disputes over fraud and so forth were really most of the story in 2009. You know, we don't know how that's going to play out in 2014.
And just remind us very briefly, Professor Carey and Colonel Cassidy alluded to this, too. This is the first step. It could take, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks before we really know what the results are.
Yeah. The IEC, the Independent Electoral Commission, is supposed to release official results from this first round later this month, I think on the 24th or by the 24th. And then there may well be a second round. So there'll be some time to organize that. And then, you know, there would be another round of counting and so forth, and possible dispute arbitration. So this could go on for a while.
Yeah, because there are 8 candidates for president, and unless somebody gets 50%, there's a runoff. Is that right, Professor Carey?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Sarwar? I'm sure you were watching this closely.
Well, first of all, I totally agree with both Bob and John. It was a hugely, hugely inspiring turnout for the elections, not just the 7 million, but also more women voted in this election than have at any time in the past. Where I take a right turn away from my two guests here is that I was not that impressed with the fact that the Taliban had not been able to do more mayhem than they had. Putting myself in the role of the Taliban, I hate to do that, why would I want to get into a fight with the enormous protection force that the Afghans had put together? The entire 360,000-person army was guarding the elections. All of the police, the remaining NATO folks were guarding it. And so I am not that surprised that the Taliban chose not to do it. Where I am looking at in the future is what happens after the elections, as the two guests have pointed out. This 360-person army that has been created by NATO and the U.S. costs every year the Afghan government more than their entire budget.
Wow.
How are we going to be able to afford this? That's one. I would remind your listeners that the United States, with a $19 trillion GDP after 10 years, has not been able to prevail on the enemy, Taliban, which has virtually no GDP. So the security issue is tough, and corruption is a huge issue. Opium today, Afghanistan supplies 90% of the world's opium. 10 years ago, it supplied 30%. That puts money into the hands of bribery of the government, of everyone at every level. And then finally, just to set the stage for the listeners, the bribery requires that roughly 85% of every dollar that's provided in aid goes to either overhead or just simply disappears. 15 cents of the dollar goes to where it's supposed to go. And the U.S. has provided $90 billion over the last 10 years. So, yes, the elections were hugely successful. We should all be grateful for that. But there are very severe problems, and I hope we can get into those as we march through this hour.
Absolutely. And let me invite our listeners to join us as well. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we sift through the Afghanistan elections, highly watched. They took place on Saturday. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. If you were looking at these elections, what were your concerns going in? What were your hopes? And as the U.S. prepares to pull most of its forces out of the country by the end of this year, what do you think will happen? Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR exchange, all one word. Professor Carey, the big question, and Sarwar alluded to this, what's at stake here for the Afghan people beyond, you know, who's elected president, who's elected on provincial councils? What are the big items at stake?
Well, I think, you know, the legitimacy of the election, if the election is regarded as having been fair producing a winner with a real mandate, then you've got, you know, a couple of main audiences. You've got Afghans themselves, and if the new head of state's regarded as a legitimate president, that might generate more buy-in to this government. You know, maybe among Afghans that are on the fence, less likely to support or be complicit with Taliban insurgents, but also, you know, sort of long-term willingness to comply with the laws, willingness to pay taxes and so forth, which is enormously important and has been, you know, sort of not really present in Afghanistan. There's also external legitimacy. As Sarwar had pointed out, Afghan is enormously dependent on foreign assistance, and the willingness of the United States and then other countries to provide aid and cooperation will also hang on whether this election is regarded as fair and legitimate. So those are critical issues. And then finally, you know, the bilateral security agreement has a timetable. The clock's ticking on that. And
that's the agreement with the U.S., right, Professor?
That's
Carey?
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. So how quickly these, we're able to resolve this election and get a new president in place is essential, because the current president, Hamid Karzai, has refused to sign the BSA. And his argument is this is, mainly going to affect the next administration. They should be the ones to sign on to it. But if it takes months for this election to be resolved, that, of course, then pushes that further down the road.
All right. Well, same question for you, Sarwar Kashmiri, and you, Colonel Cassidy. After a short break, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Back in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More on the presidential elections in Afghanistan on The Exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the worldwide debate over new rules for the World Wide Web. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from A&B Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity. For remodeling or replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonboro, and at ablumber.com. From Mark Knipe Goldsmiths, 2 Capitol Plaza, downtown Concord, completing most jewelry repairs in-house using laser technology appropriate for even the most delicate jewelry. And from Keene State College Summer Sessions, accelerating time to degree with a full range of courses in the arts, sciences, and professional programs. Registration now open at keene.edu/summer.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, an update on Afghanistan's elections held on Saturday. We invite you to join us with your questions, comments, and thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Colonel Cassidy, same question to you. The big picture, please. What's at stake with these elections for the Afghan people?
Well, I wouldn't want to overemphasize the elections themselves. The U.S. government has a tendency to view elections as something is a threshold. If you do an election well, then it means success, but there are a lot of other variables going on in Afghanistan. Why it is so momentous is that no Afghan ruler has ever relinquished power voluntarily in Afghanistan's history, and this is the first peaceful democratic transition of power. So what happens in this election could determine whether we see more stability, more legitimacy, more sovereignty in the next 5 years or less. It also will help determine the international commitment. As my colleague stated, it's about legitimacy inside Afghanistan and with the international sponsors. And yes, it is misgoverned, it is corrupt, it is imperfect, it is irregular. The elections will show there will be irregularities and fraud, but if they are seen as going relatively well, I think we can be hopeful that that is one variable that will lead to a couple other variables like the bilateral security agreement and a continued international commitment that could give just enough resilience and continuity and funding to the Afghan state to make this endeavor succeed in the end.
You know, I'm interested in the first part of something you said, Colonel Cassidy. Americans tend to overstate the importance of elections. Can you give us a little more there? What do you mean?
I just historically, and whether it was in the Balkans or in Iraq and Afghanistan, people, I don't want to overstate this, but there seems to be a sense in among the U.S. leaders that a successful election is an imprimatur for success in the whole endeavor, when successful election is only a single variable in what's going on in Afghanistan. Now, this one is important because it comes after 12 and a half years of war, and it comes after Karzai's his reign, which is viewed variously from different leaders, but it has been imperfect nonetheless. So this election, I think, is probably of scope and magnitude, probably the most important election of all the elections we witnessed in Afghanistan. But elections in and of themselves are not the panacea for everything.
Yeah, Sarwar, I'm guessing you agree with that. Go ahead.
I absolutely agree with Colonel Cassidy. I mean, we just have to think back 2 years to the wonderful election in Egypt, right? I mean, there was an honest election. You know, everyone supervised it. It worked well. Well, look at what happens after that and where Egypt is now. From my point of view, what is at stake for Afghanistan in this election is that we'll soon find out how much 10 years of American Western involvement has been able to mitigate the cultural conservatism in Afghanistan. Over 50% or close to 50% of Afghans are under 25. In this election, women voted in huge numbers. They defied their husbands. They went out in their burqas, but they voted. So we'll soon find out how much society has transformed, and I would submit the success of that transformation is part of what will determine the future of Afghanistan.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned women, because that's been a big, big issue for Western governments, including the U.S., in terms of how much they donate money, how much they're willing to work with certain Afghan groups. No women, from what I understand, Sarwar, running for president, but two running for vice president this time, and the candidates' wives were appearing with them as well. So that was a big deal.
It was indeed a big deal, and fingers are crossed. I mean, a woman running for vice president in Afghanistan is huge. Let's hope that it continues to run safely, the election, and that the results are deemed to be rather fair. I mean, if there is a future in Afghanistan, together with security and everything else, it's the women and the young.
Well, I'd love to ask our other guests about that as well. Let me also invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at the elections in Afghanistan this weekend, what they mean for the future of this country, including the women of Afghanistan and also relations with the U.S., given that bilateral security agreement that is still in play, determining how much U.S. forces stay in Afghanistan, what their role is. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Professor Carey, I read that some 300 women ran for provincial council seats, which were also at stake in these elections, even though the presidential election got the most attention. What does that say? 300 women.
Well, it's a big number. Of course, there's also a huge number of provincial council seats. But Afghan electoral law does provide, what we call gender quotas, a requirement that a certain number of the candidates and actually a certain percentage of the winners need to be women, which has, represented a huge step forward, at least in the numbers of women participating and holding public office. And these are incredibly brave women because for reasons I think we're all familiar with, the environment isn't necessarily conducive to women stepping forward and taking that public role. So we have to keep our fingers crossed about the provincial elections as well, and that those candidates are able to take office and serve.
Well, and from what I read, okay, so at least 20% of seats at the provincial council have to go to women, no matter what. Mm-hmm. I mean, how is that working or going to work? What if a particular woman only gets 5 votes? You know, she still gets a seat?
5 would be lower than any I'm familiar with. But, yeah, you touch on a really important point, which is that women, in order to meet that quota, are often seated ahead of men who received more votes. And that has been, you know, a huge concern because you could imagine the objection to that. And I think there's some sense that, you know, that the rule itself has been imposed by external forces, maybe not sufficiently sensitive to Afghan culture and so forth. And so the big concern is, or one of the big concerns is for the safety of these women who do step forward. They compete. Some of them win on the grounds of having, you know, won more votes than the other candidates, but some of them are seated as a result of the quota. And that's a precarious situation to be in.
Yeah, well, and Colonel Cassidy, I want to get you in on this too, but another question for you, Professor Carey. Again, you've consulted with Afghans on election reform. Would you have advised them to do this female quota system or not?
Well, you know, if we look around the world, there's dozens of countries with gender quotas, and most of them are embedded in an electoral law, a way of competing that's different from the Afghan one. I don't want to take you down too deep in the weeds on the, you know, the details of the electoral law, but in most of these other contexts, you don't have that phenomenon of women, you know, who at an individual level receive fewer voters than male candidates and being seated ahead of them. So I would have advised the Afghans to have adopted an entirely different type of electoral law for all kinds of reasons. Their election laws are really unusual, and they have all kinds of nefarious effects. But one of them is that they make the implementation of gender quotas really difficult.
Well, and Colonel Cassidy, I had read that some female candidates in Afghanistan were wary of presidential candidates who said, we need to work stuff out with the Taliban. We need to, you know, find a way to compromise or bring these folks back into government. And the women were saying, no, they're not feeling so happy about the Taliban. What do you think about that?
I would think if I was a woman in Afghanistan, I would be very concerned about any discussion of negotiating with the Taliban or any uncertainty about the return of the Taliban. If you just look at the societal progress, the development that has benefited women since the fall of the Taliban till now, geometric improvements across the board. This is in terms of children in school. The number of girls in school has gone from almost nil to over 3 million. Some people would put it at 4 million. The role of women in politics has improved discernibly, and the role of women in the workforce has improved discernibly. So women have a lot to lose if we see either a imperfectly or suboptimal negotiation with the Taliban or inroads from the Taliban in terms of wanting to join the government when actually they want to take over the government.
And Colonel Cassidy, were any of the major presidential candidates talking about reaching out to the Taliban?
I recall that President Karzai was reaching out on his own, but I don't think that Abdullah would be inclined to reach out to the Taliban immediately. But here's another thing about the election: one of these, whoever wins the election, will have a renewed legitimacy over Afghan sovereignty. So it's possible that a legitimate election combined with a bilateral security agreement could send a significant enough a message to the Taliban that their likelihood of victory is severely diminished. So there might be an opportunity in the next years to negotiate genuinely with the Taliban if they can be convinced that victory is unlikely for them.
Sorry, do you want to jump in? And then I want to invite our listeners to join us.
Sure. I think that the security issue in Afghanistan is the most important one that we need to think about. And part of that security situation is coming to terms with the Taliban. How we do that is the big open question. The Taliban have not only strengthened but have launched more attacks than they did some years ago. So saying that we leave the Taliban out of any final solution is wishful thinking. I wish we could, but I don't think we will.
Well, and it's worth noting that even though the elections went off relatively well, there was a lot of pre-election violence, presumably conducted by the Taliban, and a lot of people were killed, and, you know, Westerners basically fled, journalists, international monitors. The beloved Associated Press photographer was killed last week in the
Absolutely. And Pakistan, which is one of our big allies there, and we should get into this idea of the neighboring countries because I think that's important, but Pakistan very much supports the Taliban. And so the idea of coming to an agreement, a long-term agreement, without including the Taliban in some way is, I would submit, wishful thinking.
Well, and whose job is it, Sarwar, to decide what those agreements look like? I mean, is it really, if we're going to let Afghanistan run itself and the U.S. pulls out, is it really our business whether it decides to include Pakistan, Taliban, whoever?
Well, my opinion has long been that the United States is going to be, in the long run, a minor player in that game. The countries that matter there are Iran, India, Pakistan, with China and Russia looking on into the background. Of that, India and Iran are very anti-Taliban. Pakistan is more supportive. Those are the countries that have to work with the Afghans to come to a long-term solutions. And the idea of this bilateral agreement and all of that is, you know, good. We should remain engaged. But I wouldn't put too much emphasis on an American solution. That time has passed.
All right. Let's definitely talk about that. And again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. After the Afghanistan elections, what should the U.S. role be in that country? And as our troops leave at the end of this year, 1-800-892-6477. Is it time for the U.S. to let Afghanistan chart its own future? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, Professor Carey, Colonel Cassidy, Professor Carey, you first. What about this? Let's get into this. You know, what should the U.S. role be in Afghanistan as the troops leave, as Afghanistan has relatively successful elections, at least to this point? Is it time for us to just go home and say thank you very much?
Well, I think the appetite on the part of a lot of Americans is diminished for involvement, but I think we still have, you know, there are things we care about. Obviously, the stability of the country, and you know, if we remember why the U.S. was involved in Afghanistan in the first place, it's because it was used as a launching pad for the 9/11 attacks, and so the U.S. has a strong interest in preventing that kind of situation from recurring. But, we've talked about also about individual rights, and in particular about gender rights, and I think that's something that the U.S. is also really committed to, that, that all Afghan citizens, regardless of, male or female, have right to basic security, liberty, access to education, and so forth. And those are things that are not necessarily secure, and so the U.S., I think, has some legitimate role in trying to hang on to the gains that have been made.
How does the U.S. do that, then, if all the troops are out and there's a general lack of interest among the public towards Afghanistan? How does the U.S. make sure that those values are continued, those slight gains are continued, Professor Carey?
Well, I think the conditions of the BSA, the Bilateral Security Agreement, I think they probably will be that'll probably be signed and probably be reached, and the U.S. will retain some security presence there. I think it's also encouraging that, you know, there are really three main contenders in this election, and it looks by now with the preliminary vote counts as though there are two, Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah. And I think it's important that both of them have, sent clear signals that they, first of all, that they intend to sign the BSA, and second of all, these are folks that are known quantities. They've been ministers in existing governments. I think they're generally regarded as being a little bit more reliable or more predictable than the incumbent President Hamid Karzai. And so I think there's an expectation, at least for now, during the honeymoon period, that both of them will be committed to some of the basic values that the U.S. has supported since it's been there.
Okay, Colonel Cassidy, love your thoughts, too. The U.S. role in Afghanistan as the troops prepare to leave by the end of this year. It's amazing. I mean, December 2014 seems so long ago, and now it's coming.
Well, I would suggest that a sufficient amount of continued funding and a sufficient amount of advisors to stay in Afghanistan to assist the Afghan security forces with their institutions. We built an army and a police force that are good in relative terms. They can fight and they can move and shoot and communicate, but some of the higher end things like sustainment and aviation and intelligence still need some deepening and some strengthening. And history suggests across different wars, and I hate to bring up the Soviet War, but even that history would suggest that continued military and economic assistance to the government in a more circumscribed form would help that government and its security forces survive. And the Taliban are not destined to return to power. In the end, I do agree with Sarwar, every war must end, and every war must end in some sort of political negotiation. But most of the Afghans don't want to see the Taliban regime as it existed prior to 2001 return. And on Dr. Kerry's point of 9/11, I would remind the audience that we have a long history of strategic attention deficit in South Asia, and it goes back to our imprudent decision to support the Mujahideen against the Soviets for short-term gains. It ended up having long-term consequences for our own security.
Strategic attention deficit in Central Asia. Is that what you said, Colonel Cassidy?
Strategic attention deficit in South Asia, and if you spell it out, it's a monosyllabic word that is the opposite of happy.
Yeah, right, exactly. Sad. Wow, I mean, that's a pretty big statement. So that's part of the problem, is we just haven't been smart about this area of the world.
Yeah, that's part of the problem, was bad strategy to begin with, and it might have made the leaders who decided to back some of the most fanatical segments of the Mujahideen against the Soviets good in terms of feeling like they were getting retribution or revenge for the Soviet complicity in our enemy's assistance in the Vietnam War. But for us, long-term, the consequences were catastrophic because we supported the Mujahideen. After the war was over, their cohesion diminished because of the Soviet departure. The Afghan security forces actually held for 3 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks. But then after we turned out the lights in the early 90s, we let that whole thing just kind of percolate, and it ended up, not directly but indirectly, we saw the emergence of the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
All right. Well, we'll start taking your questions and comments in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the worldwide debate over new rules for the World Wide Web. Then a new memoir about coming of age at middle age. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners and from Curran Hatton Homes for Children, helping children in need grow physically, intellectually, emotionally, and socially. Information at helpforkids.org. Monadnock Chorus celebrating Palm Sunday with Poulenc, Gloria, and Dvorak. Mass in D, Saturday, April 12th at 7:30 and Sunday, April 13th at 3. Tickets at monadnock-chorus.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, campaign finance after the latest U.S. Supreme Court decision. Join us for that conversation tomorrow on The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at Afghanistan's elections that took place over the weekend and the question of continued U.S. involvement, what that should look like. Join us with your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. What should the U.S. role be in Afghanistan as our troops leave after these elections? Give us your thoughts again at 1-800-892-6477. And Sarwar, Professor Kerry, Colonel Cassidy, let's go to our listeners now. Ahmed's calling from Peterborough. Hi, Ahmed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I was just making a comment for all of us that our role in United States' role in Afghanistan extended way back to late 70s under President Carter and his advisor Brzezinski, when we injected ourselves with force to counter what was perceived as the Soviet attempt to take over the regime in Kabul. And that was Soviet intervention or support for Najib, a very secular elected leader, following the fall of the monarchy of Muhammad Shah in 1973. So we have been sort of playing a big power game in Afghanistan, although at a lower level, from early 70s to intervention in 79, and then our armed support for Mujahideen, considered to be very nationalist, liberating Afghanistan from Soviet domination.
Right. And, you know, Ahmed, this is a point that Colonel Cassidy was also making just before the break. Thank you for calling. You know, Professor Carey, he's right. There's a long history of U.S. involvement in this country, and that's playing into what we're talking about now, doesn't it?
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad the caller brought the point up, and I'm going to defer to his historical knowledge about Afghanistan. But one important point, I think, with respect to this election and its comparison with the last one in 2009, is that in 2009, Hamid Karzai, the incumbent president who was eligible for re-election, was running for re-election and actually ended up winning, made the case that the United States was interfering with that election on behalf of his opponent, actually his main opponent, Abdullah Abdullah. Those charges went back and forth. I think the important point is there was a perception among a lot of people in Afghanistan at the time that the U.S. kind of wanted to they wanted one candidate over the other. And one encouraging thing this time around, I think, is that there isn't a perception that the U.S. Has a dog in the fight. Obviously, we care about the outcome of the election, but there isn't a sense anywhere near like there was in 2009 that the U.S. has a favorite among the front runners. And that's encouraging.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Ahmed, thank you for that call. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, as we look at what the U.S. role might be in Afghanistan, especially with this bilateral security agreement that the next president is going to have to sign, Sarwar Kashmiri, you've written that it's, I'm quoting you here, high time to end the American hustle of Afghanistan. referring, of course, to the Oscar-nominated movie American Hustle. What's the hustle?
Well, I think the hustle is, as both Colonel Cassidy and Professor Carey have pointed out, the trying to influence the future direction of Afghanistan. So we've spent trillions of dollars. We've been there for over a decade. We've had thousands of brave Americans that have been killed. How much do we have to show for it? Not very much, is what I would say. And the issue to me always is that there are four countries or five countries around Afghanistan which, together with Afghanistan, will determine the long-term future. And to me, what the United States needs to do is go on a completely different track, not overemphasize this bilateral agreement and the idea that 10,000 remaining or 8,000 troops will do what 80,000 could not, but engage in diplomacy with India, with Pakistan, with Iran, with Russia, with China, to make sure what comes out of Afghanistan is going to be stability in the long term. The military solution does not work, has not worked, will not work, even though the soldiers have taken every hill we wanted them to. But still, here we are with Taliban in ascendance, corruption, instability. So engagement with its neighbors, emphasis on that, will help both Afghanistan and, I might add, the American people who are sick of seeing their money, trying to make dams that don't get built as opposed to roads in Vermont and in New Hampshire.
Well, and let me just pick at that a little bit, Sarwar, and then I want to go back to our listeners. You said, hey, we've had all this investment of blood and treasure, and the gains have been not very much. But here we've had this election, went off pretty well, considering what people were worried about, there have been gains for ethnic minorities and especially women and girls in Afghanistan. So there has been some progress, yes, at a huge cost, but some people would say that's still pretty good.
Absolutely, as would I. What I'm talking about is how do we take that progress, that enormous turnout of the young and of the women, and channel it more productively so that Afghanistan can become more stable, find its way in its region and the world. And I'm saying that we cannot do that with a military solution.
And you're saying regional emphasis more than just...
And I'm saying a regional emphasis, thinking broadly, wider optics, and not thinking in terms of bilateral solutions and 8,000 soldiers and drones that get everybody madder than they were in the first place.
Let's take another call if we could. Tim is waiting in Glen. Hi, Tim. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I hope this is presents sort of an ethical quandary. I may not be the typical American and that I'm not at all angry about money going to Afghanistan or elsewhere in terms of its potentially helping other human beings into sort of a better world. But I want to propose the notion that the U.S. intervention is a bit like gardening. New Hampshire tried to be a farming state for many a couple centuries, actually, and sort of failed at it. But if you think of a gardener as a kind of benevolent emperor, gardens are creations of artifice. They're quite beautiful. We tend to them. But if we neglect them, the indigenous weeds, excuse the metaphor, tend to come right back. And some would argue that those weeds are more natural, more beautiful, perhaps even more inclusive. There's a kind of diversity to them. My point is that I worry that even though I agree with the professor that continued military intervention is not the answer, I worry that if the United States, which clearly has its own interests, some, I believe, somewhat covert, I mean, clearly has its own interests in these foreign engagements, I worry that if it ceases to be a benevolent emperor, if you will, on some sort of ethical level, that Afghanistan and countries like it will simply resume their more naturalistic course in whatever direction they were initially headed. And I will take my comments off the your comments off the air. Thank you.
Well, Tim, thank you. And Colonel Cassidy, this is the big fear, isn't it, that if the U.S. just pulls out completely and says thank you, goodbye, you know, Afghanistan will crumble back into violence. What do you think, Colonel Cassidy? And Tim, thanks again.
Well, I'm glad Tim brought up the ethical question, because there are moral imperatives for why this war is a good war compared to the war in Iraq. Despite the missteps to characterize some of the early years, that's part of the reason why it's 12 years and 6 months now, this was ostensibly the good war of the last decade or so. I mean, our cause for going to war against al-Qaeda and the Taliban was justified in terms of self-defense. We tried to fight it with moral rectitude and tried not to kill... Try to avoid killing non-combatants, although we were imperfect at that. And then the next question is, will we do the right thing in the end, which is do more good than harm? Some people have come up with a notion of jus postbellum, which is a moral commitment to stay with your allies, supported you against an enemy in a long war. The reality is, I would agree with Sarwar, one of the biggest obstacles to long-term peace and stability in Afghanistan is Pakistan, because without the sanctuary, the Taliban would have wilted 3 years ago when we had all our forces in there and we were taking away their safe areas inside Afghanistan. They haven't gotten stronger, but they've stayed relatively the same. That's why they have not been defeated, because some of their will exists and resides in Pakistan, where we can't touch, because it plays our ally, it also plays our enemy for its own interests and strategic depth, which is beyond the scope of this hour, but that's another talk show, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's very frustrating, though, isn't it, Colonel Cassidy, to see Pakistan sort of being friendly, but also providing shelter for the Taliban?
I find it repulsive, to be quite frank.
I would love your thoughts, too, Professor Carey, on Tim's comment. You know, a little worried that if the U.S. says goodbye too quickly and too completely, Afghanistan will revert to violence.
Well, you know, I think that it's a big concern. I'm going to stay away from his gardening metaphor, because as a lawnmower guy, I think I don't really
qualify.
But you know, there is a big ongoing debate about the extent to which the United States ought to be trying to promote its vision of democracy in other parts of the world. At least looking at the most recent, you know, just the events this past weekend, I think we see, a pretty strong affirmation, you know, not of the whole Afghan political system, but of at least of this election in the turnout and in the willingness of Afghans to come out, even in the face of considerable danger, and participate in this process. So, I think that is a sign that this isn't completely a U.S. fabrication, and that there's something that's worth trying to pursue and trying to support going forward.
So, Professor Carey, should the U.S. stay there in large numbers, small numbers, moderate numbers, civilian corps, so to speak, you know, State Department folk, USAID folk, military folk? What should that look like?
Well, I'm not a security guy, and I would definitely defer to the other guests on the show. I think when we talk about numbers, we're usually talking about troops, and that's just not my area of expertise. But I think, in terms of State Department, we're going to have a diplomatic presence there. I think we ought to be trying to support the democratic process going forward. We've been focusing in the last hour on the presidential election, and the presidential election is a big part of Afghan democracy, but it's not the only part. In fact, over the last 10 years, the incumbent president, Karzai, who's on his way out now, has really done, I think, everything that he could to hamper the development of other Afghan democratic institutions, in particular their legislature, their an independent judiciary, and so forth.
Really? How so?
Well,
and why?
I think Karzai understood early on that the power of the presidency was going to be greater if the power of the other branches was constrained, and so he took some actions. One of the things we mentioned early on was the election laws, but he basically supported laws and procedures that were going to impede the development of meaningful political parties in Afghanistan. And if you look around the world, there aren't a lot of democracies out there that can succeed, that have succeeded over time without political parties. That's just that we hate them, we love to hate them, we have to complain
I was gonna
about
say,
them.
But, right.
But, you know, they're a necessary evil. And Karzai has really stood in the way of the development of meaningful political parties, and like I said, also a strong independent judiciary and legislature. So I think the next big steps, to the extent that the U.S. wants to play a constructive role in helping Afghanistan, you know, build a democracy for the long term, is to help them develop those other institutions. And again, that's a topic for another show because we're talking about the presidential election here. But that's where I would that's the basket I'd put my eggs in if I were making U.S. policy there.
Well, and as we said at the beginning of the hour, the elections were this weekend, but it's not over for a while. Just very quickly, Colonel Cassidy, so here we are waiting for results to come in, really, because it's going to take a long time. What are you going to be watching for over the next, 4, 5, 6 weeks as these results become more clear?
Well, we'll be watching to see that for one thing, to make it simple, that it's not 2009. Because 2009 was an abysmal attempt to run an election that would be perceived with relative legitimacy. So far, step one, it seems to be that there is fraud, there is some irregularities, but it seems to be more circumscribed, and then the future will tell. And then we'll be looking for what the Taliban do. Kassawar's point might have been he might have been spot on with his notion that they lay low. I mean, insurgents don't attack strength, they attack weakness. So it could be that they lay low when the Afghan security force are out in strength, and they may try something this fighting season. I would remind the audience that not only is this a difficult and very momentous election process that will occur over multiple months, but it's going to occur right in the fighting season when the enemy is going to come out in earnest to try to attack.
Kind of chilling to hear you talk about the fighting season, Colonel Cassidy.
Yes, well, this year it didn't ebb as much after the last fighting season, but generally it runs from around April to mid-fall, and it's all associated with how agrarian societies work and the harvest season for the opium poppy and all that. But generally, what most knowledgeable people on Afghanistan are expecting is they're expecting the Taliban to do as much damage as it can. this time because it will have such a significant effect, at least potentially perceptionally, on the Afghans and the international community. The goal of the Afghan security forces, of course, is to outmatch and crush the Taliban whenever they show themselves to attack a weak spot.
What are you going to be looking at in the weeks ahead, Sarwar Kashmiri? This is, as everybody has said, just the beginning, not the end.
I'm going to be looking for U.S. policy to become much more engaged in the neighbors of Afghanistan. I'm going to be looking to see how the Taliban react after a few weeks. And I'm looking to see whether the emphasis on a military solution and the idea that having soldiers, American soldiers in Afghanistan, is going to make a difference prevails, or whether common sense will, which is based on a decade of experience, let's get the neighbors involved, ourselves move away from the front line, and let Afghanistan move ahead to a stable future.
All right, all of you, it's been great to talk to you. Sarwar, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Sarwar Kashmiri, adjunct professor of international relations at Norwich University, fellow at the Foreign Policy Association. Colonel Cassidy, it was good to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Laura. Glad to be here.
That's Colonel Bob Cassidy, an Army colonel, professor at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He just came back from service in Afghanistan in February. And Professor Carey, thank you also for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Professor John Carey, chair of the Department of Government at Dartmouth College and a political scientist. He was in Afghanistan 2 years ago to consult on election reform there. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the future of campaign finance after a major U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Last week, the court removed the cap on how many candidates or causes a person can give to, but kept some dollar limits on those contributions. Now those on both sides of this issue are sorting through what it means and saying this decision could have a major impact on our national elections. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Derry Medical Center, an independent family practice celebrating 50 years of primary care for entire families with offices in Derry, Londonderry, and Wyndham. DerryMedicalCenter.com. And Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, the European Parliament voted on new rules to prevent internet service providers from blocking or slowing down services like Skype and Netflix. Efforts to impose similar net neutrality rules in this country have so far